AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
It was 1:52 a.m. on the morning of December 1st, 2019. The streets of Ansonia, Connecticut were quiet and empty. Most of the city's 18,000 residents were fast asleep, still digesting their Thanksgiving leftovers from just 2 days before. The temperature had plunged below freezing, announcing winter's arrival, while Christmas lights glowed softly in living room windows. Inside the Ansonia Police Department, it was a peaceful Sunday morning, until the phone rang.
I answered by saying, you know, Ansonia 911. There was a male voice on the other line that stated three different times Myrtle Ave.
Officer Jacqueline Tresser remembers the man's voice. Calm, slow, almost slurred.
I tried to obtain an address or location on Myrtle Ave by asking, you know, what's the house number? What is your location on Myrtle Ave? After that, the male voice kind of stopped, and then I heard a female voice in the background that stated something as, hang up, stop, who are you talking to? And then after that, I continued to say hello a few times, but I also listened to hear the male and female talking quietly in the background.
The call had lasted only a minute and 14 seconds, and when Jacqueline tried calling back over and over again, she got no answer. All she had was a street name, Myrtle Avenue, a quiet stretch barely half a mile long. She asked an officer to do a drive-through, with the lights sweeping the block, but the neighborhood looked still. Nothing seemed out of place. No one could have known it then, but that strange call was the first thread in one of Connecticut's most heartbreaking mysteries. Join me now as we look into the murder of Christine Holloway and the disappearance of her 14-month-old daughter, Vanessa Morales. You'll hear how a routine welfare check would unravel into a crime scene that shook investigators to their core. And at the center of it all, the man on the other end of that 911 call and the chilling story he would eventually tell police. Bridgeport, Connecticut is the state's largest city. Perched on the edge of Long Island Sound, it sits just 20 minutes southwest of Ansonia. And it was here, at Bright Morning Star Daycare, that 43-year-old Christine Holloway came to work each day.
She was a lead teacher, which means that she was in charge of the infant room, children that were 6 weeks old up to about 14, 15 months old.
That's Rosie Jones-Clark, who operated the daycare center.
Christina was actually an excellent employee. Her responsibilities were to make sure that all of the children were fed on time, kept them on schedule with their naps. Of course, feeding, changing, making sure the classroom was clean. She also was in charge of other teachers that would be in the room, the assistant teacher, and then, of course, floaters that went in and out of the classroom.
Caring for others came naturally to Christine. The oldest of five children, she'd always taken on the role of protector and caregiver, a role that defined much of her life. She was the first in her family to graduate college, earning a bachelor's degree in psychology before finding her calling in early childhood education. By December 2019, Christine had been a bright morning star for nearly 2 years. She was steady, dependable, someone the children, staff, and parents could always count on.
She did all the things that she needed to do. She worked well with others. I never had any problems with her. She didn't require a whole lot. She was always the same Christine, very consistent, always on time, very quiet, but yet she smiled, she'd joke a little.
Every morning, Christine arrived at work with her daughter, Vanessa. At 14 months, Vanessa was just moving up, graduating from the infant room, where Christine taught, into the toddler room. A small milestone, but one that marked the closeness of their bond. The two had been inseparable since the day Vanessa was born. On December 2nd, Christine's shift was scheduled to begin at 8:30 a.m. But that morning, she never arrived.
Christine pretty much always came early, around 8:10, 8:15. It was probably about 20 after 8 or so. We started making calls to Christine to see where she was.
Rosie had tried reaching her throughout the morning, but none of her calls were answered.
I mean, I was concerned because it wasn't like her, and I was just hoping nothing had happened to her. We began to call, at some point, family members that were listed on her paperwork, the people that she had listed as emergency contacts to try and figure out what was, you know, where she was, or in making sure she was okay. And then I didn't get any callbacks from the people that we had called on her list. So I called the Antonia Police Department.
Rosie spent about 4 hours trying to reach Christine. Finally, around 1 p.m., she called police to request a welfare check.
I asked them if there was a way that they could do sort of a wellness check to see if she was home, because we had not heard from her and she didn't show up for work.
Officer Kelly with the Ansonia Police Department was dispatched to Christine's home, 6½ Myrtle Avenue. Her small studio apartment sat above a 3-car garage, reached only by a ramp that led to the second-story balcony. After arriving, Officer Kelly knocked on Christine's front door. He even tried tapping on the windows, but there was still no answer. No sign of distress. No sign of anyone. So a few minutes later, he left. As the afternoon wore on, Christine's family grew more concerned. Her brother Stephen and his girlfriend Jody had been calling all day. They even drove to Christine's apartment twice, once around 3 p.m. and again at 5 p.m. Still, no sign of Christine or the baby. Worried, they made the half-hour drive to New Haven, where Christine's boyfriend, Jose Morales, lived with his parents. Jose had been dating Christine since 2016 and was Vanessa's biological father. Although he lived with his parents during the week, he spent most of his weekends at Christine's apartment. Steve and Jody asked Jose if he'd seen Christine earlier that day. He told them he'd seen Vanessa and Christine around 7 a.m. that morning when they left for the daycare. But, like them, he hadn't been able to reach her since. By 7:30 that evening, Stephen and Jody went to the police. Christine usually checked in often throughout the day, but this time, there was nothing.
I met with a Stephen Holloway and a Jody Jacobellis. At first, I called the number that was provided to me for Christine Holloway's phone, and after one ring, it went straight to voicemail, as if it were off or being ignored.
That was Officer Paul Smith, who met with Stephen and Jody that night.
I obtained contact information for Jose Morales, which was Christine Holloway's boyfriend, dialed Jose Morales' phone that was provided to me. The person that answered the call was a female. I requested to speak with Jose Morales.
It was Jose's mother, Lydia, who answered the phone before passing it over to Jose.
When's the last time you spoke to them? When's the last time you saw them? He stated that he saw them this morning prior to Christine Holloway going to work, the morning of December 2nd. I asked what kind of automobile she had. He said that she had a 2002 Mazda Protege, color gold. I had a DMV collect printout of cars registered to Christine Holloway, and a gold 2002 Mazda Protege was not on there. She had a 2017 black Ford Focus.
Jose said he wasn't aware Christine owned a black Ford Focus. And when the officer pressed him further, Jose shifted his story.
He changed from seeing her to only speaking with her on the phone. That he only spoke with her this morning. That he stayed at his house in New Haven and she stayed at her house in Ansonia. I asked him if it appeared odd that he hasn't spoken with her, that she has had no contact with him.
Jose was now adamant he hadn't actually seen Christine or Vanessa that morning. In fact, he said the last time he'd seen them in person was on Friday, November 29th, 3 days earlier. Maybe it was a simple miscommunication, but if Jose was telling the truth, it meant no one had actually laid eyes on Christine or Vanessa in 3 days. Either way, Ansonia police now knew this was more than just a missed day at work. The situation was urgent.
When I first started noticing my hair thinning a few years ago, I tried everything to address the issue, or at least I thought I had. I bought expensive serums, scalp scrubs. I even tried a weird rosemary oil thing that made me smell like a holiday roast. And still, I'd look in the mirror and think, is it getting worse? What I didn't realize was that everything I was trying was surface level. Nothing was actually addressing what was happening inside, causing the thinning, like stress, hormones, and the necessary nutrients for healthy hair. I was so fed up, it had gotten to the point where I stopped even trying to style my hair. I'd just pull it back in a ponytail or a bun because I didn't want to risk any more breakage. And so it felt safer to do nothing than to make it worse. That's until I started taking Nutrafol's Women's Balance formula about a year and a half ago. The number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand trusted by over 1.5 million people. Now, what I love about Nutrafol is that they take a proactive approach by supporting your hair and whole body from within. And I can honestly say it's the first thing I've tried that's actually made a real, lasting difference. 6 months in, and my hair felt noticeably thicker, stronger, and healthier, and I wasn't afraid to put some heat on it anymore. What I also love about Nutrafol is that it's not full of a bunch of random ingredients I've never heard of before. Everything in it actually makes sense. You can feel great about what you're putting into your body with Nutrafol, since Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are backed by peer-reviewed studies and NSF content certified, the gold standard in third-party certification for supplements. And if you're not in the same stage I'm in, they've got other formulas too, based on your age, lifestyle, even one for men. So if you've been dealing with hair thinning and have no idea what to try next, I highly recommend you give Nutrafol a shot. See thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. And for a limited time, Nutrafol is offering Minds of Madness listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter promo code MADNESS. That's Nutrafol, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS. We've also provided a link in our show notes.
Sergeant Alexander Barrera of the Ansonia Police Department decided to conduct an immediate follow-up at Christine's apartment. The first thing he noticed was her car, a black Ford Focus, parked on the street.
I wanted to see the residence for myself. In the front door, we observed a note left behind by Christine Holloway's family asking her to contact them when she returned home. We also noticed a skylight that was left open to the front of the house. The screen door was open, it was unlocked. I attempted to opened the next door, which is the front door, but that doorknob was locked. I knocked on the door, yelled police department, and rang the doorbell, but no response. At this point, I could see that there was lights on inside that residence.
Seeing lights on in the inside, Sergeant Pereira forced entry.
Well, once we were inside, we realized it was a studio-style apartment with a open floor plan. It wasn't very big. It was essentially the same size as the three-car garage beneath. I proceeded to go in first. Officer Nelson followed behind. When I proceeded straight through, Officer Nelson went to my left. Directly on my right-hand side, I observed a crib and a rocking chair. When I shined my light inside that crib, I noticed there was no sheets or bedding on that crib. I proceeded to go into the living room where I noticed the ceiling fan was left on and it was set at high. I continued into the bedroom of that residence and noticed again that bed had no sheets or blankets on it.
A candle still flickered in a jar on the kitchen counter. It had been burning for hours. Then came the discovery that would stay with them forever.
At this point, Officer Nelson, I could hear yell something to the effect of, "Oh shit, oh f-," and it was coming from the bathroom area. When I walked into the bathroom, I noticed in the tub a pale, naked female body laying in there. Next to her was what appeared to be a human internal organ now laying outside her body. Her hands were also covered with what appeared to be dry blood.
Christine Holloway had been deceased for more than a day.
Officer Nelson and I both backed out of the bathroom. I advised him to continue to clear that residence and to look for the baby. In the living room, on the carpet next to the crib, was a large, dry blood stain, very faint, almost like it appeared to have been recently washed.
Ansonia police were now dealing with two crises at once, a homicide and a missing child. Inside the apartment, detectives began a painstaking search for any trace of 14-month-old Vanessa. Among them was Detective Hart.
At that point, we went in under exigent circumstances, myself and one other officer. We had donned protective footwear in order to cover our boots. We had donned gloves to make sure that we kept the crime scene safe and evidence intact. Went in searching for Vanessa in places that the original patrol officers, when they went into, may not have looked. So we did a little bit more of a thorough search and looking in spaces where a child of that size may be. In doing so, I recall passing across a couple different items in plain view in the house. The diaper bag stuck out to me because there were so many things in the diaper bag that a child would need for daily care. I recall seeing a pink Croc inside the diaper bag. And my question in my head became, if the diaper bag is here, then where is Vanessa?
The discovery of the diaper bag and everything a toddler would need inside only deepened the urgency. That night, police issued a silver alert for Vanessa Morales. By the following day, it had been upgraded to a nationwide Amber Alert.
Now, Fox 61's Gabby Molina joins us now live from Ansonia with the latest.
Right now, what's happening right now in Ansonia is family members and friends and members of the community are handing out these flyers with Vanessa's picture on them. Four pictures of Vanessa, all trying to find her, trying to spread the word here. We have not seen these pictures yet, so take a good look. There are some really, really clear photos of her face. She has brown hair and brown eyes. And that's right, family members have met here in Ansonia to spread the word about this. And I'm joined right now by Vanessa's cousin, Joshua. Joshua, tell us a little bit about what has been going through the family's mind these past few days.
It's very hard on my grandparents, and I could only imagine the other side of the family. We just want her home at any means necessary. We just want her home safe, healthy. I mean, Christmas is coming. Like, you know, she got to have her second Christmas, you know what I mean? And it's cold out here.
The search for baby Vanessa was now a race against time. As dawn broke on December 3rd, Detective Kevin Duggan with the Connecticut State Police arrived at 6.5 Myrtle Avenue to process the scene.
So as you enter the apartment, you walk on the tiled floorway for about 4 to 5 feet, and then you enter the living portion of the apartment, which is a carpet or rug. And it's a gray-colored rug. The gray-colored rug has a large portion of reddish stains on the rug. A bed that has no comforter, no sheets on it, and other bedding and clothing items surrounding the bed.
The studio apartment told a grim story. Someone had attempted to clean up a large amount of blood from the living room floor. Spatter marked the rocking chair, the crib slats, even Vanessa's toy box, and the toys inside.
So in the tub, there was the deceased's body. There was leaf and other debris down near the drain portion of the tub. And there were fragments of what appeared to be skull-like material in the tub.
Detective Esposito then made another grim discovery.
I focused my direction to underneath the sink of the home, inside the kitchenette area of the apartment, and the drain trap of the garbage disposal. So when I disconnected the pipe and, you know, tilting it and taking it over the paint can to catch anything that could have been still in the trap, I heard a distinct, like a distinct pinging sound of like a substance of some kind that was still contained within it, hit inside the can.
Inside the trap were several small white fragments that appeared to be bone.
Those were subsequently sent to, brought up to the office of the chief medical examiner for a further examination.
An autopsy would reveal the full extent of Christine's injuries.
She had numerous blunt force injuries over her body. Numerous and extensive blunt force injuries to her head. Above her right ear is a large skin injury with fracture of the underlying skull. The brain itself had been partially what I call traumatically eviscerated, which just means that the trauma was so severe that a large part of the brain had come out of the skull, and the brain itself had also numerous blunt force injuries. And some of the skull fractures had a what I would call a scalloped appearance, so it was semicircular.
The autopsy findings were devastating, revealing the violence Christine had endured. The wounds pointed to a weapon small and rounded, likely the head of a hammer, and the fragments recovered from the kitchen disposal were confirmed to be Christine's. Her official cause of death was listed as blunt force injuries to the head and torso. And still, one question overshadowed everything. Where was baby Vanessa? While state detectives worked inside the apartment, Ansonia police canvassed the neighborhood. Next door, they spoke to George O'Mara. George remembered seeing the first welfare check around 1 p.m. on Sunday, December 2nd.
He walked up the ramp leading to 6.5 Myrtle. Went up, knocked on the door. He was there for a few minutes knocking, and I saw him get in his car and leave. Probably 10, 15 minutes, I guess, at the door. I believe it was around 12:30, 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
But it was what George saw next that made investigators stop cold.
About 20 minutes or so after he left, I saw Jose come down the ramp, head across the street towards his car. I was getting ready to go out because it snowed lightly, and I was going out to clear the steps. And while I was out there, Jose came back up, and he was heading back into 6.5 Myrtle Avenue. And I wasn't really that interested because, you know, it's Jose. He lives there, and he's just, you know, leaving his house. I recognized him. He was heading back up the ramp, and actually, I think on the porch itself. And I said to him, like I said, it was pretty casual. I said, I'm already tired of this winter shit with the snow. And he said, well, it's just beginning. And then he went inside. A little while later, he came out again, went into his car, and left.
If George was right, and there was no reason to doubt him, it meant he was now the last person seen at 6.5 Myrtle Avenue. The next morning, detectives went to his parents' home in New Haven. Jose didn't resist. He calmly agreed to ride with them to the station for questioning. At 43, Jose's story stretched back to Puerto Rico, where he was born, before moving to Connecticut as a boy.
I was born in Puerto Rico. We first came into Cheshire, and then from Cheshire, we moved into New Haven. My mom, my two brothers, and my father, but my father ended up going back, so my mother and my two brothers. When we got here, I went into middle school, 7 and 8 in Fairhaven, then high school, and I got a little bit of college education from Gateway Community College.
But life in Connecticut hadn't been smooth for Jose, and his troubles with the law began when he was a teenager. Over the years, his record grew to include drugs, larceny, gun charges, domestic violence, and repeated violation of protective orders. Then in 2012, he was convicted of a felony after attacking a former girlfriend while high on PCP. Court documents say he pinned her to the floor. A witness reported hearing him threaten, "I'm going to break all your bones." The woman already had a restraining order against him at that time. It was a violent past, but a few years later, Jose met Christine Holloway.
Well, at first we met through a dating app, and we started communicating. Then we exchanged numbers, we started talking, and eventually things grew and we got to know each other good and we started dating. Around 3 years, I was living with my parents in New Haven, and I had an apartment with Christine in Ansonia. In the weekends, I lived in Ansonia. In the weekdays, I lived in New Haven because I had two kids that... In New Haven, I lived with my two kids in my parents' house, and then I ended up having a kid with Christine, so we got an apartment, and I was also living there.
Christine had always dreamed of becoming a mother one day, and despite their unconventional living arrangement with Jose, splitting his time between two homes, Christine was overjoyed when she had Vanessa in her early 40s. Jose's parents, Lydia and Marcos, told police that Christine was a wonderful person and a part of their family, like a daughter. They also described their granddaughter Vanessa as a sweetheart they adored. The picture painted to police about Christine and Jose was a couple building a life together, stable, serious, and devoted to their daughter. But when detectives interviewed Jose on December 3rd, the picture he painted was very different. He minimized the relationship, saying they weren't that close, and even claimed he used the word girlfriend loosely. He added that his family didn't really like Christine. Throughout the interview, Jose insisted that he'd last seen Christine on Friday the 29th and hadn't been at Christine's apartment at all that weekend. Instead, he said, he'd spent the entire time with a friend named Hector in East Haven. The detectives noted Jose seemed unconcerned about the entire situation. And yet, at this point, they hadn't even told them the truth, that Christine had been found dead. Still, Jose didn't ask a single question about Christine or about his missing daughter. When detectives confronted him about his lack of emotion, his response was chilling. "Do you want me to cry?" After the interview, Jose was escorted back to his parents' home. It was there that detectives finally told the family what they'd found: Christine murdered in her bathtub. Jose's mother broke down in tears. His stepfather tried to comfort her, his face stricken with grief. But Jose sat silent, unmoved. While searching Jose's bedroom, detectives uncovered two stun guns. For anyone else, it might not have been that unusual, but for Jose, a convicted felon, it was illegal. That was enough to put him in handcuffs on weapons charges. Just 2 days later, the investigation shifted in a way no one expected. The break didn't come from a crime lab or a police lead. It came from a charity worker emptying a clothing donation bin outside a church. Her name was Mira Watkins. She worked for an organization called Kiducation. And on December 5th, she was simply going about her day.
"We have bins in parking lots and store parking lots where people can go and donate clothes and other goods. We have a couple trucks and routes that go and pick up the stuff from the bins different days. We bring them back to the warehouse to be sorted. He would start throwing the bagged clothes to me. I would throw them further back into the truck."
As they collected the items, Mira noticed something disturbing.
"We first saw a diaper genie that was covered in a red substance.
Diaper genies are specialized trash cans designed for disposing of diapers and baby wipes. But this one appeared to be covered in blood.
I took a picture and sent it to my boss, just to know how to proceed and what we should do.
Mira was told to gather any suspicious items into separate trash bags. Dozens of kids' toys, clothes, towels, and one pink crock stained in blood were collected. Then came the final suspicious items. 7 unopened envelopes, each one addressed to Christine Holloway. Mira's boss wasted no time.
I Googled the name, Christine Holloway. I found there was an investigation going on. I called the police and Ansonia. I told them that I had a letter on top of some stuff that we had collected at a clothing bin, and it had matter on it, and I was very concerned. I didn't touch anything, and I didn't let anyone else touch anything.
It didn't take long for investigators to confirm the items belonged to Christine Holloway and Vanessa. The pink crock matched the one found inside Christine's apartment, and forensics later confirmed the blood on the items was Christine's. But buried in the grim evidence was one thread of hope. There was no sign Vanessa had been harmed. In fact, many of her essentials were still unaccounted for. Her car seat, her polka-dotted comfort blanket, her favorite teething rings. To detectives, it suggested something remarkable. Maybe Vanessa was still alive. So on December 6th, Ansonia police made a direct appeal to the public.
Vanessa Morales is still missing, and we, along with the FBI, Derby Police, Connecticut State Police, are still following leads to locate Vanessa to return her home safely. Finding Vanessa and bringing her home safely is our overriding concern. We are not looking to arrest or start criminal proceedings against whoever has Vanessa. We just want to know where she is and that she is safe and well. It is imperative that we find Vanessa. She's a 1-year-old child who is wholly dependent on others for their care and well-being, and we know locating Vanessa would bring a sense of relief to her family. We are very hopeful that we are going to find her. We believe that she is with someone safe, and we want to make it a priority that they understand. Whatever circumstances that they have received Vanessa, just bring her back to us so that we know she's safe. Our priority is Vanessa's safety, bringing her home.
In the days that followed, investigators began stitching the pieces together. And with each new discovery, the picture pointed more firmly toward Jose Morales. Cell phone records showed his phone ping near Christine's apartment throughout that weekend, the same weekend he claimed he hadn't been there at all. Those same records revealed another chilling detail. Jose was the one who made the anonymous 911 call at 2 a.m. on December 1st. Surveillance cameras added another layer. Footage captured Jose's car passing the Kiducation donation bins just hours after the call, and more video placed him leaving Christine's apartment roughly 40 minutes after the first welfare check on December 2nd, just as neighbor George O'Mara had reported. By early February, the evidence was impossible to ignore, and on February 7th, 2020, Jose Morales was formally charged with murder and tampering with evidence in the death of Christine Holloway. It would take 5 long years before Jose Morales finally stood trial for murder, but even then, he was never charged in connection with his daughter's disappearance. Over the years, police and Christine's family never stopped searching for Vanessa, yet despite countless tips and exhaustive efforts, what happened to her remained as much as a mystery as the night she vanished. While in jail, Jose continued to maintain his innocence, but in the weeks after his arrest, his story shifted. He admitted to being at Christine's apartment all weekend and cleaning up the crime scene, tossing items into the donation bin, and moving Christine's body into the bathtub. But as for who killed Christine and what became of Vanessa, Jose spun a very different story. It was the same story he would repeat years later at trial. According to Jose, the weekend began with an ordinary Thanksgiving.
We had a Thanksgiving meal together. We play around, everybody enjoy. We were just in the house hanging out with each other. Everybody was playing with Vanessa. We had a good time. It was a good Thanksgiving day. No problem, no trouble, no nothing. We just enjoying each other.
They spent Thanksgiving night together at Jose's parents' house. The next day, Jose said, was about errands and a car.
So Friday, I got up early. Well, around 8 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning. I played with Vanessa for a little while, and we started talking about a noon appointment that we had because she was using my car. So we went to Barberino's to purchase a car for Christine. Well, we got there around 12:15, and we were there till like 5 o'clock.
After Christine bought a black Ford Focus, they returned to Jose's parents and started decorating for Christmas.
Well, after a while I was decorating the Christmas tree, somebody started calling me or texting me.
The person calling was Jose's friend Hector in Bridgeport. According to Jose, Hector needed a ride somewhere, so Christine took Vanessa back to her apartment while Jose drove to Hector's.
I went into Hector's house, picked him up, and drove to Bridgeport. So as we're driving away, he's rolling a blunt. I'm thinking that he's rolling weed, but I'm not sure because I'm driving and he's guiding me around. So he starts smoking. He passed it to me. I start smoking too. So we start smoking together. Next thing you know, I wake up somewhere else in Bridgeport in the passenger seat of my car with Hector in the driver's seat.
According to Jose, he'd unknowingly smoked PCP, or angel dust, a drug he'd used since he was a teenager. Jose testified that Hector gave him two additional bags of PCP before they split up, and that he went back to Christine's apartment. The following day was Saturday, November 30th.
Well, that day, we woke up around 8 in the morning, 8:30. We were just in the house. I didn't do nothing. We didn't go nowhere. We were watching TV all day, right? So around midnight, I started getting them cravings for dust. It was going through my mind that I still had two bags of dust left. So the craving was getting the best of me. So I told Christine I'm about to roll a bag and smoke. She said, okay. So after I rolled a bag, I went outside to the front of the apartment to the deck. I was out there for like 10, 15 minutes smoking, and I smoked the whole blunt.
He said the effects hit him hard. Disoriented, he went to the bathroom, his usual spot to smoke a cigarette with the window open.
I got super high, so I stumbled my way inside of the apartment. I left the door open, and I walked right inside into the bathroom. In the bathroom, I sat on the toilet. Not to use the toilet, but just to sit there, because next to the toilet, there's a window.
From there, he claimed, he saw movement from outside. Two people approaching.
One of the individuals started walking across the street towards the apartment, and he did a bit of a jog towards the apartment. When I saw that, warning signs and bells and alarms started running through my head. Try to work my way out the bathroom to close the front door. But because I was so intoxicated, I couldn't really move. I went in my pocket, I grabbed my phone, and I dialed 911.
He said his slurred speech on the call was the drugs. He also said Vanessa was quietly watching TV and that Christine told him to hang up so he wouldn't wake her. What happened next, he told detectives, unfolded fast.
I got hit on the right side of my face. I lost my balance, so I fell. I got on my knees and my hands, and I got hit right around my chest area. I'm on the floor, and I can hear that there's a struggle going on in the bed area. There's a fight. I hear screams. At the same time, I hear that somebody leaves the apartment.
Jose said the first man to leave was carrying Vanessa. He claimed Christine chased after them, and the second man turned on her.
The guy that she was struggling with was chasing her, but she doesn't get that far. She either trip or collapse. The guy that's running behind her stops and hits her with a crowbar. He gets up, he starts pacing. "Bitch, you scratched me." That's what he says. So he hits her first, one time. He's angry and he's cussing out. He hits her two more times. As he's hitting her, I'm still on the floor. I tried to do something, but I can't because I'm stuck. I'm PCP and I'm stuck. I was in the verge of passing out. So the only thing that I can do is scream. I try to scream, "Stop." He looks at me. He points at Christine with the crowbar. He said to me that if I call police, the same thing will happen to your daughter. He walked out of the apartment.
Jose testified that the threat of this mysterious intruder is what kept him from reporting the crime.
I wanted to call police, but at the same time, I kept hearing those words in my head.
Jose said he then stumbled out of his front door and watched the murders and kidnappers drive away.
There was a bag on the floor. I grabbed it and I started putting stuff in it. It was a small white plastic, the regular garbage bags. So I started putting some of the stuff that was on the floor inside a garbage bag. Everything that I saw around Christine, I started putting it inside bags. I didn't want nobody to see her like that. So I gently grabbed Christine and I placed it in the tub. And I see the blood all over the hallway floor and by the door entrance. And I went and I grabbed the bucket from under the sink with towels. So I started just cleaning the blood that was on the tiles and I cleaned it up with the bucket and I was dumping the water from the bucket into the garbage disposal.
This was Jose's version of events, a story of murder, kidnapping, and a cover-up driven by fear for his daughter's life. Jose would later claim that because of the PCP, he didn't remember the attack during his first interview with police. When the trial finally began, Jose's defense team insisted that his testimony wasn't some elaborate story patched together years later to match the evidence. They argued it was consistent with what he had told police all along, once the haze of PCP began to clear.
"We know the state has not proven a murder case against Jose Morales. Who calls 911 before committing a homicide? There's no evidence there was any problem between Christine Holloway and Jose Morales on that date. Morales had ingested PCP on December 1st. You can hear it in his voice. He was barely able to speak. Voice slurred. No screaming or yelling between Jose and Christine. No physical violence, no confrontation whatsoever. Morales was interviewed December 3rd, December 12th, December 17th, December 23rd, January 9th, January 21st. As Morales's memory came back from the use of PCP, he told the police what happened. This is not some manufactured story from 5 years later. This was contemporaneous with his arrest and the investigation in this case. As soon as Morales's PCP clouded memory came back, he told the police what happened."
The defense pointed out that Jose admitted to cleaning up the crime scene, but argued that didn't make him a killer.
"There's no evidence of Jose Morales' DNA under Christine Holloway's fingernails. If this was this brutal murder committed by Jose Morales that the state alleged, you would see that evidence. The fact that Morales readily admitted cleaning up does not mean that he committed the homicide. Apples and oranges. Totally separate issues. Does it make any sense to commit a homicide? Just think about this. Commit a homicide and then go ahead and put the crime scene evidence in a donation bin, by definition, where it's going to be found. Does that make any sense to you at all? No, it doesn't."
But the prosecution dismantled that narrative piece by piece.
"The defendant would have you believe that everything in his world was bright and rosy. He talked about the wonderful holiday season he and his family were having at Thanksgiving time in 2019. But the reality for Christine Holloway was anything but that. Hardworking, church-going, dedicated, single mother. Mr. Morales told you he was unemployed, stressed, living with his elderly parents in their basement, together with his two other children, who his parents were also supporting. He acknowledged that he was a part-time parent and part-time partner to Christine and Vanessa. He denied being a controlling and jealous, abusive man. However, his text messages tell a different story. Clearly, he controlled and scrutinized her. Where was she? How did she spend her money? She professed her love for him and told him about the beautiful future she envisioned for their blended family. He admitted to calling her a pig, that he would swear at her awful, nasty words. He didn't trust her. He believed she was seeing other people. And no matter how much she reassured him or professed her love for him, she was never good enough. He toyed with her emotions, telling her, "This stupid relationship is done." That's only days before Thanksgiving.
They pressed on the fact that Jose had denied being with Christine for nearly 2 weeks before finally introducing PCP into the story.
Jose Morales spent nearly 2 weeks following this crime denying he was even with Christine Holloway that weekend. He denied it to the Ansonia police, the Connecticut State Police, the FBI, his own family. You saw it on the tape before finally introducing PCP into the conversation.
The state argued that the PCP story was nothing more than a smokescreen. If Jose was truly incapacitated, how could he have done what he did next?
No one took into account his post-homicidal behavior. And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this is where the whole PCP story falls completely apart. We know that by 6 a.m., the defendant leaves 6½ Myrtle Avenue in a car full of bloody stuff that he placed in garbage bags. He carefully goes through all the stuff in the house, separates out the bloody stuff, carefully bags it, doesn't get blood on himself in the process, or cleans himself up before 6 a.m. when the cameras catch him making his run to the education bins. How is he cognitively doing all of this a few short moments after smoking PCP, a drug with an average half-life of 8 hours? Does this behavior sound like a person that is cognitively struggling with planning? He drives all the way down to St. Michael's Church using cognitive goal-driven behavior together with working knowledge to reach the bins that he knows are present at that location. Mr. Morales and his attorney would like you to believe that he is cognitively impaired during this time, but his actions and abilities paint a very different picture.
And beyond his actions, the prosecution asked jurors to think critically about his story of home invaders.
Why would you believe that home invaders who committed murder and kidnapped a child would leave behind a living witness? How does that make sense? Do you believe that they would also stop to take a child safety seat for the child at the scene of a homicide as they're making their getaway? Does any of that make sense? And what does Mr. Morales do instead of calling the police or calling for help for Christine? He engages in a methodical cleanup over the next 37 hours.
After 10 days of testimony, the case went to the jury. It took them less than 2 hours to decide.
In the case of State of Connecticut v. Jose Morales, has the jury unanimously agreed upon a verdict?
Yes.
Have you find the defendant as to the crime of murder?
Guilty.
In July 2025, Jose Morales, now 48 years old, was sentenced to 65 years in prison. Justice for Christine Holloway finally arrived 5½ years after her life was brutally taken. To her family, Christine was so much more than a victim. She was a daughter, a sister, an aunt, and above all, a devoted mother. Kindness came to her instinctively, whether with family, friends, or complete strangers. Children lit up around her, and she lit up around them. Her work as a daycare teacher wasn't just a job. It was where her joy lived. For those who loved her, the guilty verdict brought some measure of justice, but it didn't close the wound. Because for Christine's family, one question still eclipses all others. Where's Vanessa? The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has released an age progressed image showing what she might look like now at 6 years old. Her family believes she may still be alive, possibly even living outside the U.S. For them and for law enforcement, the search has never stopped. If you have any information about Vanessa Morales, please submit an anonymous tip to the Ansonia Police Department at tip411.com. That's tip411.com. Somewhere out there, a little girl may still be waiting to come home to a family that has never stopped loving her, never stopped hoping, and never stopped believing. Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.